On June 8, 1978, Alexander Solzhenitsyn went to Harvard University and delivered his now famous commencement address, A World Split Apart. It was, to say the least, not what people expected or wanted. This is the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. By the time he delivered the Harvard commencement address, Solzhenitsyn had been living in the United States for some time, observing our politics and our culture. In the address, he offered a critique of our ideas of freedom and the good, of our sense of well-being, of our overall short-sightedness, and of our lack of spirituality. Wyoming Catholic College sophomores read Solzhenitsyn's Harvard commencement address as part of Trivium 202, Political Rhetoric and the Common Good. In that course, they not only study great examples of rhetoric like this one, but learn to write and deliver speeches of their own. With those students at home across the country, Drs. Virginia Arbery and Pavlos Papadopoulos recorded this conversation about Solzhenitsyn's famous Harvard address.
I wanted to begin just by asking you, Dr. Virginia, about Solzhenitsyn's Harvard address, because you remember this happening as a kind of public event or semi-public event in 1978. So I guess, could you just say a little bit about what it was like when you heard about this, if you read it or saw a recording, and what the kind of conversation around this speech was at the time?
Yes, Dr. Papadopoulos, it was a charged reaction, partly because the question arose quickly whether he was, in fact, an adversary instead of a friend, as he claims he is at the beginning of that speech. There were several other high points, of course, in his thinking about the West, because he came here in exile in 1974, and he was living in Vermont already for 4 years when he gave this speech. And he had already the reception of a Nobel Prize for Literature. So people were very familiar with his thought and his work and were quite favorable to it. But in this speech, he seems to question, though I think we could discuss this, you know, the nature of democracy and the kind of soul that it results in, and whether, in fact, it's a better kind of soul than the soul of the suffering subject under a tyranny. And I think there are many ways to qualify that, as I'm sure you won't want to do, but in any case, some people didn't hear actually what he was saying, at least it seems to me, about the nature of liberty and its and its limits. But yeah, anyway, to answer your question, it was very controversial. I was out east around that time with my great aunt and uncle who lived there and who were pretty much Boston Brahmins, as they say, and we were at the Harvard Club, and you know what that whole world is like, and they were just incensed with the temerity of Solzhenitsyn to critique America since we had given him hospitality in his exile.
Well, that sounds like an interesting contradiction to one of his critiques, well, partial contradiction to his critique that we have a kind of lack of manliness that even a Boston Brahmin in the late 70s would rise to the occasion of defending America. But set that aside for a moment. Just to backpedal for a moment. You mentioned that, you know, everyone was sort of up and or favorably disposed to Solzhenitsyn before this in America. Everyone, you mean liberals and conservatives.
Was this
a partisan issue or no, before the speech?
No, I don't think it was a partisan issue because nobody in the press, I'm thinking of Arthur Schlesinger, who was advisor to John F. Kennedy earlier in his career, but the historian was very favorable to him previous to that. I mean, we hadn't heard a explicit attack on some of the negative sides to liberal democracy that he was pointing out. And but we had heard with favor all of his criticism of tyranny. Of course, communism was the great enemy. And he was the one, along with several others, who, through his heroic writing, got the message out that this was not a happy regime where all classes were equal, but in fact it was a repressive regime by a few of the many, and resulting in 60 million deaths. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it was the kind of shockwave then to hear him use the kind of insightful language of soul deprivation that was the case in Russia, and then to apply it in different terms, but in very striking terms, to American democracy and Western values.
Yeah, and notably, this is a, I guess what you could call, in a broad sense of the term, a conservative critique of liberal democracy or modernity or American democracy or something like that, right? You would have been very familiar with Marxist critiques of liberal democracy at the time.
Indeed. But I think that would be useful for you to clarify that for our students, what you mean by a conservative critique.
Yeah, a critique... not so, as opposed to a Marxist critique, which might criticize America in the 1970s or today for being materialistic and individualistic and concerned with the pursuit of actually, I mean, in a lot of ways, there's certain overlaps here. The pursuit of individual satisfaction and a kind of selfishness, which. Mm-hmm. We in America might say is, no, this is the pioneer spirit, the American, as Roosevelt says, American ruggedness, rugged individualism, all of that kind of self-assertion and pulling oneself up by one's bootstraps. A Marxist would say that that's all a kind of ideology of self-interest. It's actually spread to the masses to keep them complacent in this capitalist system, which actually only benefits the few who are on top, right? That kind of left-wing Marxist criticism, which you could see being taken up. Let me set that aside. As opposed to that, what we have from Solzhenitsyn is, a deeply spiritual or religious criticism of America. And a conservative criticism in the sense that he's bringing to bear a broader perspective than just the kind of dominant concerns of the 19th, 20th century, which is what Marxism is doing, right? And saying that capitalism does not secure this as well as communism does. Instead, Solzhenitsyn has this really long, long perspective in saying that there are some virtues and vices to the Middle Ages and of the Renaissance, and what we're seeing right now is this corruption of something that may have been decent in its conception in the Renaissance, but now has degraded into this kind of misuse of liberty and corruption and sort of anthropocentric. I mean to say by that conservative critique is that it's not critiquing America for being unequal or unjust from a Marxist perspective. It's instead critiquing us for having fallen away from our spiritual heritage as citizens of the West or of Christendom in a very broad sense.
Yeah. I think that's well said. And that, as you say, that long view, that vista that he has of the history of the West, affirming both its virtues and criticizing its vices, I think puts him in the category of a great man. And in this regard, if we could focus on this a bit, I think it will be helpful in the students' appreciation for their next exercise, which is the disoi logoi, where they make a claim about the nature of a concept or a verity, such as greatness, and then look at it from two sides, coming down on the one that they first propose as more correct. And so if we look at greatness, it would seem to be that this prophetic role that Solzhenitsyn assumed by looking honestly at the good and the bad of the Renaissance and the Enlightenment really made him one of the first to point to postmodernity, where we are now. He's really looking at the time when all the promises of the Enlightenment are beginning to unravel. Mm-hmm. They're not satisfying us because they spend too much attention on the physical at the expense of the spiritual, as you said. He reminds us of Socrates in this regard, the gadfly to Athens. I mean, he's the one who makes you uncomfortable. But he also says, Socrates says, I'm your greatest friend. And right. So Nietzsche says, I am your friend.
I've been set to sting you like the gadfly stings the cow, and the cow should be thanking the gadfly, right? So we should be thanking Solzhenitsyn. So could we turn to the Solzhenitsyn speech in a little bit more detail? To what extent in what way is Solzhenitsyn critiquing the American regime or critiquing a corruption of the American regime? He's not talking about our regime in the prosaic sense of governmental structures, although he has things to say about legalism, and that's very important for his argument. But sort of in the broader sense of our mm-hmm. regime, our former way, our form of order in society, our way of life. Mm-hmm. Is it clear to you whether he's going after the American regime in that broad kind of spiritual sense, or going after a corruption of it, or a corruption of the West, which has now corrupted everything, including the American regime? Is that the question? Yeah.
He doesn't make a formal critique of the ruling structure. That is to say, you know, the three branches, the Constitution, and so on. But he does make a very strong affirmation of the principles of the Declaration. Mm-hmm. And he does look with great care into what the meaning of happiness is. Mm-hmm. And he reminds us that happiness, it cannot and was not, in terms of our own most important pre-founding document, it cannot be severed from that superior being. Mm-hmm. All of it depends on, so that the self-indulgence that he finds so corruptive of young people, for instance, and of our statesmen, neither of which have courage, that kind of misunderstanding of happiness has really led to what he describes as a decadent understanding of freedom, right? And one that doesn't really lead to happiness. And so that kind of critique is a critique. I mean, he doesn't really place it, let me be clear about this, in, say, progressivism mm-hmm. or anything in particular that happened politically. I mean, it leaves that up to us, I think, to think about. But what he's reminding us of is the rootedness of the principles in a spiritual truth and a higher truth to which we must recur, or we're not any different than subjects of our own pleasure. It's a different kind of slavery, but it's still a slavery, mm-hmm. you know, than the one. Yeah, and that legalism, I don't know if you want to take that up, but that's a very important critique, it seems to me.
Yeah. I, before we do that, I want to just come to the first passage. I think this is the first passage where he mentions the Declaration of Independence. This is
let's do it. Mm-hmm.
Shortly after he announces the decline in courage. So a couple paragraphs after decline in courage first appears. Mm-hmm. And he says, when the modern Western states were being formed, it was proclaimed as a principle that governments are meant to serve man, and that man lives in order to be free and pursue happiness. Parenthetical, see, for example, the American Declaration of Independence. Now at last, 1978, now at last, during the past decades, technical and social progress has permitted the realization of such aspirations, the welfare state. Mm. But then he goes on to say, every citizen has been granted the desired freedom and material goods in such quantity and such quality as to guarantee, in theory, the achievement of happiness in the debased sense of the word, which has come into being during those same decades. So that first part that I read, it sounded like the welfare state and the American 1978 is sort of the culmination of what America was from the beginning. But then he actually clarifies and leaves the opening to us, as you said, to fill in the rest of this political history, which is that the notion of happiness itself has also changed in our common or political understanding in those same decades leading up to 1978. And that they, and he says later explicitly, I think it's quite a bit later in the speech, that that the original notion of happiness, this is towards the end, after he's introduced the history of the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. He says, and yet in the early democracies, as in American democracy at the time of its birth, all individual human rights were granted on the ground that man is God's creature. That is, freedom was given to the individual conditionally the assumption of his constant religious responsibility. Such was the heritage of the preceding 1,000 years, 200 or even 50 years ago. So 1928, nice Coolidge reference. It would have seemed quite impossible in America that an individual be granted boundless freedom with no purpose, simply for the satisfaction of his whims.
Right. So you have very important qualifications, and including right after that, the clarification of a conservative critique, as you've put it, of liberal democracy and a communist one. Because the word here that's so charged and problematic is humanism. And many critiqued humanism when it became the word of the intellectual class in the 1920s and 1930s. People like Alan Tate were writing against humanism in the way that some of the integralists and some of the people currently are, who talk about it as a, you know, because of its anthropocentric emphasis, as a kind of departure from the medieval synthesis. And it's really the downfall. So, so the humanism that is so pernicious, and I think we sometimes forget this in our celebration of the Renaissance and so forth, but it, it's so pernicious, is the kind that doesn't have any gratitude for the gift of the nature of things as they are, that they're given and they're not constituted by our making or our will, but we have to cooperate with the natures of things as they're given by a divine source, as opposed to, you know, making things happen because we want them to be a certain way. Can we talk a little bit about the legalism? I'm reminded so much of that scene in The Clouds that all of these sophomores read with you, with their with Pheidippides going into the little think tank and looking at the map of Athens, and you know, he's like, where are all the juries? There should be a million juries here.
Sparta is so close. Oh no, there's Athens. That can't be Athens. I don't see any juries, right? Great joke, because the Athenian people were known to be really litigious, right? Really prone to prosecuting each other, just as just as America is known to be litigious. This is why we have a lot of jokes about lawyers, sort of at the expense of lawyers, because we're kind of comically trying to deal with this uncomfortable fact about ourselves that we're overly inclined to prosecute other people. Is that what you're driving at there?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, he says it pretty beautifully. He says, the law is great. We don't have it in the Soviet Union. You know, it's great that you have law. But if law becomes everything, you know, it's too fluffy. It doesn't really, doesn't have the tissue, the ligaments to really bind people together. It doesn't have heart. And that, you know, it's these ineffable things that... that he talks about that are, that make it difficult for Americans in 1978 or perhaps even now to understand, because we want to be so proud of our legal foundations. We want to say, oh, well, that's our safety. That's our protection against tyranny, but you know, fine, but that's not enough, right? It becomes a substitute for the things that Tocqueville talked about, the habits of the heart. It becomes a substitute for real mores, right? Mm-hmm. And that means that culture is pretty threatened because you don't have a good fiber in your people anymore. Don't you think the students could be thinking here too of George Washington's farewell address? Mm-hmm. And his, so he's emphasizing the forms over and over again. He's going through the Federalist Papers basically. But then he says, you know, without religion and morality, you can't really be a friend of liberty. You can't be a friend they're the pillars, right? And I think we're just being reminded of that fundamental foundation here in his critique.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
I'm just thinking, you're not, y'all don't live in it. You're living in the fruits of it. But the 60s were wild. The period of just questioning language, the meaning of words, using them in different ways, just like in the Corsairian revolt in Thucydides. You know, you couldn't depend on words having their real meaning anymore, right? Everything's twisted. That's what happened in my generation. That's what happened to us in college. Mm. Yeah.
Let me use this opportunity to quote Nietzsche. I don't want to resist a moment to quote Nietzsche, because Nietzsche says somewhere that it's something to the effect of, so he talks about God being dead, but he says, we will not actually be free of God or free of religion until we are free of grammar. Right.
I think
idea being so I mean that relates, if you degrade grammar, then you're degrading our ability to connect with or perceive or be receptive to nature and supernature. There's that kind of intimate connection, and so that's a plug for studying grammar and studying the trivial arts. They really are necessary for thinking in an orderly way, and thereby seeing the order that is in nature, and that points to supernature. Mm-hmm. So the degradation of grammar, and of course you could also think about C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man, which begins with criticism of a contemporary textbook for English, for learning English, basically for grammar and studying grammar, and then moves from there to this very very dark dystopian future in which we've abolished our own humanity.
Isn't it in the Abolition of Man, Pablo's, where he talks about where Lewis talks about men without chests?
Yes. Yeah. And second chapter of the
Abolition. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, so yeah, this is certainly Solzhenitsyn's point of departure. That's his first critique.
The decline in courage, the lack of manhood or manliness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that connected to the legalism?
I bet it is. That's an interesting question. What makes you ask it?
Well, I'm just looking back over the text itself and wondering how he transitions to talking about legalism. So he had been talking, I read that the first instance of the Declaration, a little bit after that, he talks about how we in the West are free from state pressure, we've been granted well-being that our grandfathers couldn't have imagined, and so on and so forth. Yeah. There it is. So who should now renounce all this? Why and for the sake of what should one risk one's precious life in defense of the common good, particularly in the nebulous case where one's security of one's nation must be defended in an as yet distant land? I don't know if he's talking about Vietnam there, but he is talking about how our amazing comfort and high standard of living encourages the lack of manliness, and specifically discourages us from serving in the military or risking our life in some other way.
Then
he goes on to say, even biology tells us that a high degree of habitual well-being is not advantageous to a living organism. Today, well-being in the life of Western society has begun to take off its pernicious mask. And then he says, Western society has chosen for itself the organization best suited to its purposes, and one I might call legalistic. So my professor brain told me when I was reading, you know, put in a little marginal comment, transition question mark. Because I'm trying to understand the transition between that discussion of the decline in courage and our legalism.
There's no explicit transition, but one could say that legalism itself becomes a mask for the well-ordered society, because the well-ordered society depends on the well-ordered soul. That's his emphasis over and over again. Mm-hmm. You can't have an exterior order without an interior order. And so legalism is a prop, but it should only, it can only be a prop that is valid if the interior order is there. So, I mean, all of these examples of legalism are what you can get away with. The more litigious you are,
right,
the more you try to get away with things. It doesn't really order the soul itself.
That's really nice. That's great. That's very helpful. It's just, so let me just set up a proportion. As there's a kind of false sense of welfare, right? Welfare in the sense of the welfare state mm-hmm. now today, and a mm-hmm. false sense of or degraded or lower sense of happiness mm-hmm. Prevalent now, mm-hmm. as opposed to the older, fuller sense of welfare, right? In the preamble to the Constitution, one of the purposes of the government is to promote the general welfare. Mm-hmm. You can think about other statements from political philosophy about the welfare of the people being the end of government. Just as we've kind of degraded our understanding of those key terms and key end goals of government, welfare or happiness of the people, so we've degraded from genuine virtue, what he says, you know, voluntary self-restraint and these other signs of a genuinely well-ordered soul, to just the appearance, the presentation of good order, which is that we have a system of laws that are supposedly going to impartially adjudicate between conflicting claims, right?
You know, it's just refreshing, although it didn't seem so to my aunt and uncle and many other Harvard-type intelligentsia, but it's refreshing to encounter his speech again and to see the affirmation of evil, mm-hmm. you know, the corrosion of evil, as he puts it in the section following the legalism, where he's talking about the direction of freedom. And he says, life organized legalistically has thus shown its inability to defend itself against the corrosion of evil.
Yeah.
There's a seriousness about Solzhenitsyn that's shocking to a self, to a complacent society, you know, made complacent, as you read, from our well-being. Yeah, so it's shocking to think, oh, we're not capable of this evil, right? And that's what's really, I think, I know it sounds odd, but refreshing about the talk. He reminds us that Mephistocles is, right behind every curtain, waiting mm-hmm. come in.
If I may bring back that that quote from Strauss that you mentioned at the beginning, his impromptu eulogy to Churchill, there's a passage in that where he says, right, we have to train ourselves and train others. We political scientists have to train ourselves and others in seeing things as they are, and seeing them in their greatness, their misery, excellence and vileness, and so on, so that we never mistake mediocrity, however brilliant, for true greatness. And then he adds, in our age, this duty demands of us in the first place that we liberate ourselves from the supposition that value statements cannot be factual statements. And this is, he's talking about the fact-value distinction, which Weber and other early 20th century thinkers proposed, which is basically that you have two categories, right? You can make statements about facts, and that's kind of the realm of science and true knowledge. And then you can make statements about values, sort of normative judgments about right and wrong, as opposed to kind of existence and non-existence. But that these operate in two very, very distinct worlds. And you can't actually have anything approaching scientific knowledge about values. Mm-hmm. Values, and then there's facts. And when it comes to facts, you know, you look to science, and science gives you the answers. when it comes to values, well, that's just, you know, you have your opinion and I have my opinion. And
this is what Socrates was fighting. I mean, this is Thrasymachus. This is Callicles. I mean, we're just, when they get to the point where they're studying social contract thinkers, they'll see how all of those really important verities are jettisoned just out of the conversation because they, of course, can't be part of the formulaic way we approach politics now. Well, the liberal humanism theme that we've brought up is so vulnerable. Liberal humanism, Solzhenitsyn will say, is easily co-opted or just taken into radical thought. And then he goes on to say, radical thought moves into socialism, and socialism is powerless before communism. This is such a contemporary thinker.
As Dr. Arbery pointed out, Solzhenitsyn's Harvard commencement address has much to say that can inform our thoughts about our current moment politically, with or without adding in COVID-19. It is well worth the short time it takes to read Solzhenitsyn's address and the much longer time required to ponder it. At the end of that address, Solzhenitsyn said, "If the world has not come to an end, it has approached a major turn in history, equal in importance to the turn of the Middle Ages to the Renaissance. It will exact from us a spiritual upsurge. We shall have to rise to new heights of vision, to a new level of life where our physical nature will not be cursed as in the Middle Ages, but even more importantly, our spiritual being will not be trampled upon as in the modern era." For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.